Yes, thank you, Simon. Actually, I was going to stay down there, but perhaps I will stay up here. Fine, thank you. And firstly, I do feel I need to apologise to those of you who feel you've seen rather a lot of me over Christmas. Those of you who went away obviously made the better choice, and perhaps won't be quite so fatigued by my presence. Anyway, we're starting a new series this morning, specifically on Proverbs, before we're going to move on to some themes related to Alma's vision statement, but we'll come on to that later and they'll support that. But let's focus on Proverbs this morning, and we've got a short series entitled Seeking Wisdom, Trusting God, and Words of the Wise. And I'm starting off by seeking wisdom. Now, a few years ago, at my last significant birthday, I had a number of birthday cards, and one of them came with a message on the front. I can't quite remember what it was, but it was along the lines of, the older you get, the more your physical abilities decline, but the more your wisdom increases. And you open the card inside, and it said, sounds like a pretty rough deal to me. And in fact, this badge, which I'm sporting today, you won't be able to see it, shows a slightly toothless dinosaur holding a sign that says, older but wiser. Since we can't stop the clock, we might as well get some benefits from being older. But perhaps I don't need to be seeking too much wisdom anyway. Now, King Solomon, you will remember, asked for wisdom as a particular gift from God at the start of his reign. And you can read about that in 1 Kings chapter 3. And he famously made use of it initially by suggesting cutting a baby in half. But you'll know the story well. I can't help feel that someone who eventually had 700 wives and 300 concubines rather lost sight of what he was given the gift of wisdom for. More seriously, of course, we've just been through the Christmas season, and of course we've thought about wise men seeking and coming to Jesus as a baby. And actually, if you read on in the Christmas story, only just a couple of verses in Luke's Gospel, Luke tells us that even Jesus, as he was growing up, he has these words about Jesus as a child and says that he grew and became strong. And he was filled with wisdom and the grace of God was upon him. So even Jesus in his earthly incarnation needed to seek out wisdom. Now, Simon's briefing notes for this passage were either Proverbs 9 verse 10 or Proverbs chapters 1 to 9, which is quite a big difference. So you'll be relieved to know that I've decided to go for the single verse and not the whole nine chapters so that we can get home by lunchtime instead of probably by about Wednesday. Once again, I'm starting off a sermon series, and I thought it'd be helpful this morning, since it is a new series, to share a bit of learning on wisdom literature from the Bible, particularly Proverbs, because it's not straightforward. There are some issues with that, as you may know. And this is to encourage us and to help us to read it with more confidence, if that's needed, to avoid the kind of mistakes which some people have done in terms of reading Proverbs, and perhaps also to answer critics who might throw at us some quite difficult verses that come from Proverbs, which are difficult to understand out of context. So I've recommended this book before, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth, by Fee and Stuart. And it's really an excellent start if you want to study the Bible in a bit more detail, if you're a sort of occasional preacher, you know, if you're preparing messages. So it's certainly helped me a lot with my Bible reading over the years. And if you don't believe me, it was also a recommendation from John Mark, who's known to a lot of people at this church, when I went on a kind of informal preaching course with him many years ago. So that's also a good recommendation. So it's a good place to start. Now, the thing with Proverbs is, this book has 13 chapters, 10 of which cover different genres and styles of biblical literature. The one on wisdom literature is the second from last, just before the standalone chapter on Revelation, which rather suggests that wisdom literature does have some issues and may be a bit more difficult to read. So apologies for those of you who may not learn so much this morning, but Proverbs is mostly a collection of memorable aphorisms or maxims, pithy sayings, if you like, which are generally about practical attitudes and behaviour. Although, bear in mind, quite a lot of them are also about, they're set in the context of an ancient agricultural community, so they won't be immediately transferable to modern life. You may also have heard this expression, a text without a context is a pretext. So a text, a verse, without context is a pretext. And it is very easy to use individual verses from Proverbs to justify particular positions, and they have been at particular times. If you think about it, the parables of Jesus can also be sometimes difficult to understand, but the help with those is if you look at what came before or what came after, the context there often unlocks the interpretation of a parable of Jesus if it's not immediately clear. But you don't get much context with Proverbs. So I'm going to lean on this book and give you a quick summary of some of the things that Fee and Stuart say with respect to Proverbs, just very quickly. So they generally express general truths in an easy-to-remember way, often using figurative language and often using literary techniques. But the problem is they use the figurative language and the literary techniques of the ancient Hebrews, not of 21st century English, although there is a little bit of overlap. So you have to keep that in mind. They're predominantly practical, particularly not to be used for establishing doctrine or historical points. And in actual fact, the very shortness of them and the easy-to-remember aspect of them sort of mitigates against actually establishing much in the way of doctrine. If you get very dogmatic if you just take a verse out of context. And they're worded to be memorable, not technically precise. And also back to the Hebrew poetry as well. So you may need to update a proverb from its ancient context. And this is a case where actually a literal translation won't help you very much, but actually a paraphrase may be particularly helpful in kind of unlocking that or opening that up. And finally, I could say a lot of other things, but they're particularly not to be used for selfish behaviour or to be seen as guarantees from God that the righteous will live longer, be blessed with riches, children, sheep, camels, etc. They're general principles, not doctrinal points. So they won't be inconsistent with the rest of the Bible or with Jesus' teaching, even if they sometimes appear to contradict themselves. They certainly can't be used for a kind of materialistic lifestyle or a prosperity gospel, which I think is possibly what the authors of that book are concerned about being American authors. Ultimately, they're about practical advice for general living. But you might have to look behind what the actual words are to the principles. In the same way as you can look through all those very dry and ritual laws in Leviticus and elsewhere, if you get behind what's the principle behind that, then that will establish what we should be looking for in modern life and how to apply that. So we may have to update the application, I guess is what I'm saying. Okay, a quick overview of Proverbs. There's a general prologue, which Elwin read to us. Then you've got a whole series of short sections with various benefits of wisdom and warnings about folly. And then we get this invitation from wisdom personified in chapter 8, which is often taken to be a description of Jesus before creation, we call the start of creation. And if you read that, you'll see why. And actually, it reads very like John chapter 1 as well. And then that section kind of finishes off with a contrast between invitations between what's colloquially been called Lady Wisdom and Dame Folly. And I thought I'd put that in because it is, after all, the end of Panto season. Some witty person supposed to shout out, oh, no, it's not. Thank you. Okay, and then we've got our key verse, verse 10, sandwiched in the middle of those two invitations. And you can do a kind of compare and contrast on those if you want to. It's take your time on that, that's fine. It's a nice and easy thing to do, and you'll see that. And then you get basically 22 chapters afterwards of assorted proverbs. Now, there are general themes that crop up in them quite regularly, but it's a bit like that, probably that large box of Christmas chocolates you've worked your way through recently. They're similar, but different. And some of them are easier to get through than others, but you usually find that the kind of all the hard cases and nutty ones are left at the bottom. Okay, so I've said quite a bit about Proverbs. Perhaps I ought to say a little bit about wisdom and give you a quick definition. Now, I can remember once, what really stuck in my mind is that as a shallow teenager, I can remember asking my history teacher what the difference was between intelligence and wisdom, because he seemed like the kind of man who might know. And actually, I didn't know it at the time, but actually he was a very committed Christian and an elder in his local church. And his answer was that intelligence is to do with knowing about things and facts, and wisdom is about knowing what to do with those things, how to behave, what the decisions to be made. And you probably know the old saying, we could even call it a proverb, which describes it like this, that intelligence is knowing that tomato is a fruit, and wisdom is knowing that you don't put it in a fruit salad. So it's kind of practical applications of that. Okay, so let's look at verse 10 in a bit more detail from chapter 9. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. And I'm going to read on verses 11 and 12 as well, just to illustrate what I've said earlier. For through wisdom your days will be many, and years will be added to your life. If you are wise, your wisdom will reward you. If you are a mocker, you alone will suffer. But these verses don't guarantee long life or reward for the wise, or just desserts for mockers. And if we approach these verses thinking that, I'll get wisdom to extend my life, then obviously we're missing the point. The general principle is, if you live wisely, you will probably live longer and be blessed with riches and good things, and if you are a mocker, you will probably suffer from having made poor decisions. But it's not guaranteed in that sense. Now, verse 10, if you may have noticed, hopefully, was a repeat of verse 7 from chapter 1, which says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, which is the same, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. So this verse makes a sharper contrast between the wise and the foolish. So I'm going to say a bit about the fool, who is a character who crops up a lot in Proverbs and also the Psalms, as you may well know. And the footnotes in the NIV translation helpfully suggests that when the Old Testament, or when the English translations use the word fool in the Old Testament, they're talking about someone who is morally deficient, not someone who is mentally deficient or stupid. Presumably the translators couldn't come up with a better word, because all the translations I checked had fool written in them. Even the Amplified Bible could only suggest arrogant fool. But perhaps that's actually quite helpful, arrogant fool, because actually this emphasises the attitude of the fool towards God. It's the pride, if you see, in self-sufficiency, the person who can manage by themselves, the person who doesn't need to rely on God and rejects him. The person of whom Isaiah says in a number of places, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes, clever in their own sight. In fact, Proverbs really rubs it in, if you want one example. It says in chapter 26, verse 12, do you see a person wise in their own eyes? There is more hope for the fool than for them. The fool, in effect, is saying that they have nothing to learn from God, the all-knowing, all-powerful, all-wise, all-loving God, the God of creation who has conceived and made the entire universe to his own template, the God who asked Job, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand who marked off its dimensions, etc., etc. Actually, great to sing those verses earlier on from Job, wasn't it? Indescribable, uncomparable. God goes on like that for four chapters, at the end of which God can only confess, surely I spoke of things which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me. So it's the height of arrogance for the fool to despise wisdom and instruction, to think there is nothing to learn from God, or even that he knows more than God, which is why the Bible views the fool as someone who's morally deficient, even evil. Because obviously to reject God in a way is to choose evil over God, self over community, sin over blessing. Well, that's enough about the fool, perhaps, and what to avoid. Just briefly, Proverbs also mentions a number of times the person who is simple. And verse 4 of chapter 9 helpfully perhaps explains that that's someone who lacks judgment. So this is not the innocent, perhaps like newborn children, but perhaps those like children or those whose moral compass is not yet formed or not very well formed. Perhaps they're too easily led by other people. And this is why Lady Wisdom sends out her maids to invite those who lack judgment And what does she send them out to? I don't know if you noticed that there, but actually she sends them out to something that sounds like a description of communion. It's meat and wine on a table in her house. So she's inviting them to communion with God and to walk in that way of understanding. But whether we're simple or not, we all need to seek wisdom from God, which apparently we do by coming in fear. So what does Proverbs mean when it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom? What does it mean by fear? Clearly this can't be a kind of cringing, cowering kind of fear, because that wouldn't be consistent with the rest of the Bible. It wouldn't be consistent with what the Bible says about the relationship between God and his people, either in the Old Testament or in the New Testament, or what Jesus says about it. And granted, Jesus rightly taught us to pray, Abba, Father. And I do think sometimes, perhaps in this modern age, we were sometimes a bit too familiar at times with God in certain ways. We need to remember that God is the eternal Lord of creation and master of the universe. We are mortal and sinful creatures standing on one planet around a star in a galaxy of billions of stars in a universe of billions of galaxies. We could perhaps do with a bit more awe in our appreciation and understanding of God. And I think actually if we had that, we would also be more awed by the fact that he offers a relationship to be his children in each case and to know each one of us, as John says in his gospel. So what the fear of the Lord means in this case is a reverent fear which responds with obedience to his word and worship to his person. And that, for us, will be the beginning of wisdom. That's the way to seek wisdom, not to seek it for our own sake, which, as I say, we'll misinterpret and miss the point, but to seek it, actually, as a way of seeking God. Now, I confess, I didn't much like these verses when I was a young Christian. As a scientist, it seemed wrong not to seek knowledge for its own sake, or to be able to work things out from first principles rationally. But perhaps that is, rather than starting with the fear of the Lord, but perhaps that's kind of an error of the Enlightenment. And I still think the Enlightenment was good and a necessary thing, at least as far as science was concerned. It was necessary to move science beyond where it had been, to superstition, into a more rational understanding of the material world. And in fact, the very basis of that understanding was built upon the fact that God has built a rational and reliable created order, and that he doesn't arbitrarily break his own rules, except in very exceptional cases, of course. And I think today's atheistic advocates of the Enlightenment seem to forget that it was all started off by scientists, mathematicians, philosophers, and other people who were almost entirely devout Christians. And they were only seeking to understand that because they believed in a rational, ordered God, and that was the God whom they worshipped. For example, Sir Isaac Newton, of all people, is supposed to have thought that his rather heretical Bible commentaries were actually greater works and of greater benefit to mankind than everything that he wrote on mathematics, astronomy, gravity, and optics. It turns out, actually, he was rather a dodgy theologian while still being a great scientist. But I think he would primarily have described himself first and foremost as a Christian, as most of those other people would have done. The problem started with the Enlightenment when people started to believe their own propaganda, that you could be rational in your own eyes, or as Isaiah says, become wise in their own eyes. A trend which Isaiah noted 2,500 years before the Enlightenment, in actual fact. And if you remember, it was seeking to be like God and having knowledge of all good and evil is what Adam and Eve wrecked their intimate relationship with God over. So if we are wise, we do need to start with the fear of the Lord. And that will help us to keep our perspective and our values in place. And as is often the case, I don't know if you noticed in those verses, God will actually give us the reward we might have sought, but in a different way. Because the second part of our verse says, we will get understanding, but it will be defined as a knowledge of, or perhaps a knowing of, God. So it turns out that wisdom does come before knowledge or intelligence, or if you prefer, theology comes before science. Although, don't rely on Newton for your theology. You'll be okay with the science. So how should we respond? Well, I think the response is obvious in a way. It's to respond in faith. A reverent fear of the Lord means to recognise God for who and what he is, creator and Lord, and ourselves for who and what we are, fallen creatures, and our place in the universe, which is limited and mortal. And if you think that sounds like a pretty rough deal, a bit like my birthday card perhaps, or worse, and I do have some sympathy with that point of view, I have to say, God doesn't impose himself on any of us. Even the fool, everyone's got free will, and even the fool is given liberty to go their own way. So I'm going to finish with some familiar and perhaps yet surprising words in the context of what I've said from Psalm 8. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. Through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them, human beings that you care for them? You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honour. You have made them rulers over the works of your hands. You have put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds and the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky, the fish in the sea and all that swim in the paths of the sea. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. We seek wisdom by seeking God first, and we will understand the order of creation. We will actually see things more as God sees them, and that will be true knowledge, because that is a way of true seeing. And we'll also recognize, as from this psalm, that God actually has made us the pinnacle of his creation, to be its steward and to worship him through it. So, in summary, as we seek wisdom, let's reject any foolishness or foolish thinking, have a reverent fear for the Lord, and respond in faith.